Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the battle spaces of that war, oftentimes in its fashion, is the United Nations, particularly at this moment in the year when, well, it seems like every head of state in the universe is in New York City. It is a moment that Donald Trump will be featured as we speak, that is in the future. It will have happened by the time this program airs, but we're going to talk a bit about what we think the president will address and its implications, among other topics, with Brett Schaefer. He is the J. Kingham Senior Research Fellow in International Regulatory Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. He's also the author of Conundrum, as in C-O-N-U-N, drum, The Limits of the United Nations and the Search for Alternatives. It's great to have you back. Brett, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk about activities in what they call Turtle Bay today.
That's great. I'm happy to be on there.
Brett, let's talk a little bit about what we saw the president engaging in yesterday. There's always lots of to-ing and fro-ing with the various bilateral meetings. Today, as I said, he is expected shortly to speak to the full General Assembly. What are we to make of the president's statecraft at the United Nations at the moment?
I think that the president and Ambassador Haley are doing a pretty interesting and successful job of working with the organization to press forward in a number of different areas. They've gone to the Security Council several times now in response to provocations by North Korea and have tightened the screws on that nation in terms of elevating and increasing the number of sanctions, getting Russia and China to go along with those increased sanctions, which is no easy task. They've also advanced in a number of different areas the reform agenda of the United States. As you know, the president's budget calls for substantially lower contributions to UN organizations. And the congressional budget that was just passed also enforces current U.S. law, which caps U.S. contributions to UN peacekeeping at 25%. So there's a difference of 3.5 percentage points between what the UN charges us and what that law says. And so we're going to be in arrears now. So there's going to be a task and a goal of this administration and Ambassador Haley in particular in spearpointing that on trying to lower U.S. dues to the organization to that level. And it's going to be difficult because we're talking about a zero-sum game here. The less we pay, the more other countries have to pay, something they don't look forward to.
Brett, one of the things that there's clearly some dynamic tension over is the role that Donald Trump clearly envisioned for the United States, what he famously characterized as America First, a sovereignty-based approach, on the one hand, and this idea that there's some sort of obligation or at least opportunity through collective action at the United Nations to get things done on problems that are confronting, well, multiple nations, if not the entire world. How do you see the president working his way through that seemingly divergent course?
Well, I think it is a sharp distinction from the previous administration. The Obama administration seemed to look at the U.S. role in the world as managing declining U.S. power and trying to advance and advocate these sort of ephemeral global goals, you know, the betterment of mankind, et cetera, which are fine in the abstract, but are very difficult to reconcile and sell to your country as how you're benefiting them in particular. And so the President Obama was very much enraptured and enamored with this idea that the role of the United States was to sort of advance the goals of the United Nations, not so much the goals of the United States. And this was a sharp distinction from the way the, you know, more traditional American approach to foreign policy, which is you advance America's goals and America's interests, and by doing so, you help mankind in that way. And so I see this as Trump's America First policy, not so much as an isolationist policy, but more of a return to a national interest-oriented foreign policy.
And when you hear people suggesting, as I think some of his senior subordinates have, that he'll be sort of approaching this with the idea of making the UN great, does that sound as though he's sort of lurching into the same old, romanticized image of the UN as a solution to global problems?
I don't think so. I think what he's doing is he's challenging the member states to actually have the organization live up to some of the responsibilities that they would like it to assume. For instance, in the UN Charter, the UN is supposed to be a champion of human rights, but instead we get the Human Rights Council, which includes countries like Venezuela on its membership, and Saudi Arabia and Cuba and China, who are obviously not paragons of human rights practices. And I think what it is it's a challenge to the member states to have the organization focus more effectively on advancing the principles that were outlined at the birth of the organization. Not that it's going to supplant the nation state, not that it's going to become sort of a supranational government, but in a way that actually advances or becomes a useful tool for the United States to advance those founding principles, which we all agree with. We want the world to be a more peaceful, secure place. We want the world to be more respectful of human rights and individual freedoms. The question is, how do we make the organization better equipped to fulfill those goals?
Rick Schaefer, let me ask you finally, Elliot Cohen, a man who is prominent in national security and international circles in Washington, D.C., a never-Trumper prominently, but nonetheless a man who served in the George W. Bush administration, has recently come out with a denunciation of Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, as the worst Secretary of State, I think, in the nation's history. Give us a sense from your perspective. You've been talking and writing at the Heritage Foundation about steps that the Secretary is taking to try to drain the swamp and, you know, the necessary elimination of a lot of slots there and generally reduction of personnel. What is your sense of his performance to date?
Well, I think it's been good in some respects and disappointing in other respects. And I think Mr. Cohen is exaggerating to a great degree when he says he's the worst he's ever, you know, in the history of the Republic or whatever he characterized him as. Secretary Tillerson came into office. He came into office with a president who is mercurial and sometimes changes policy without a great deal of advance notice. And so he's been caught off guard at points where his message and the message coming from the White House have been inconsistent. And that's caused some points of tension. I think he's also, unfortunately, been hindered by the lack of political appointments within the State Department, which is to, you know, undermine their ability to actually advance a lot of the policy agendas and work in a very energetic and quick fashion to advance the policies of the State Department within that organization, but also more communicate them abroad. And so he's suffered under some limitations and some difficulties, but he's also undertaken a very, I think, important and difficult task in reorganizing the State Department. When you take a look back over the past 20 years, everybody on the left, on the right, in the think tank community, in the State Department, everybody's acknowledged the fact that the State Department isn't really fit for purpose right now, that it's an organization that is too bureaucratic, poorly structured, structured largely for the Cold War era, not for the era of today. It doesn't match well with the other parts of the government, and it needs to be reformed. Tillerson's undertaken this task, and we'll see what happens at the end of this process, but he has ruffled a lot of feathers within the State Department and within the foreign policy establishment community. And that, I think, is largely attributable to a lot of the criticism that he's received, is people that are concerned or alarmed at the changes that he may be or may not be pursuing. There's a lot of rumors about that back and forth. But and so the reaction is over concern about changes that they may or may not support being enacted on a department that they care a great deal about. And so I think he's getting a lot of blowback in anticipation for what he may do in terms of this transformation.
You said something interesting a moment ago. You talked about the interests of the State Department, and I'm always struck by the degree to which that's what the State Department is all about, not necessarily the president's interests or even, I would argue, the national interests. you are a close student of these matters and an extraordinarily astute observer and commentator on them. Brett Schaefer, we are very pleased to have you with us. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Michael Pregent. We'll talk with him about Kurdistan and what may be coming in that part of the world and what it might mean for you. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a great pleasure to say, joined by Michael Pregent, one of the most serious thinkers and, well, practitioners of national security policy, particularly in the Middle East, currently doing all of that primarily from Washington, though he has just returned from a country he spent a lot of time in as a United States Army veteran, as well as an intelligence analyst with the Defense Intelligence Agency. He served in combat during Desert Shield and Desert Storm. He is these days helping, among other things, to run a very important organization, Veterans Against the Iran Deal. That would be, of course, what we call around here the Obama bomb deal, the fraud that was supposed to disarm the Iranians and is, I'm afraid, simply emboldening and empowering them. Michael Pregent, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes to join us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm particularly interested, Michael, you've spent a lot of time in Iraq, as I mentioned, and in particular working with the Peshmerga along the trail, the military of the Kurdish areas of Iraq. The Kurds will, of course, be having a referendum on whether to go their own way on the 25th of this month, assuming the pressure being brought to bear on them from the government in Baghdad and others doesn't stave that off. Give us a quick readout on the Kurds of Iraq, whether this is a good thing for them as well as arguably for us as well.
I just returned from the region, and I went there to get my mind changed because a lot of my colleagues here in D.C. say we need to support a one Iraq policy. Iran really doesn't have that much influence in Iraq, and if they do, it's because they're neighbors. And we should be against this Kurdish referendum. Well, I used to be a one Iraq guy, but that was before we handed over the country. And when I say we, U.S. policies basically handed over the security and intelligence apparatus to the IRGC and their proxies.
That would be the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, not the kind of people you want to be empowering, needless to say.
No, I mean, and again, Iran's strategic goal in Iraq is to develop a land bridge so they can move supplies and personnel into Syria, into Lebanon, and threaten Israel. Well, the Kurds play a big part in being a bulwark against Iran's intentions in Iraq. And, you know, I met with Kurdish leaders, and they said, listen, if we stay in Iraq, there'll always be a Shia prime minister. The Council of Representatives will always be majority Shia. And these Shia political parties are tied to Iran. Iran decides who the prime minister of Iraq is going to be. And this push by the United States, specifically Brett McGurk and the State Department, to say that the Kurdish referendum would somehow be a slap in the face to the U.S. military after the loss of blood and treasure in Iraq is outrageous. I served with the Peshmerga, an independent Kurdish region, after we've failed to keep Iran from taking over Iraq would actually be a testament to the sacrifice of the U.S. military in that country. And I'm on record being a one Iraq guy, and I was before Ramadi and Mosul. I was before I saw the complete takeover of the Iraqi military intelligence apparatus facilitated by the United States because we ignored the role of the IRGC in Iraq.
And when you say Ramadi and Mosul, you're talking about basically the Shiite forces now dominated by the Iranians, unmistakably militias and the regular army, I guess. destroying Sunni cities and essentially now dominating them, presumably, which will not be a good thing for the Sunnis in Iraq. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately aided by U.S. airstrikes. I mean, the counterinsurgency is supposed to protect the population. It's a key pillar of counterinsurgency is protect the population, not punish the population. And, you know, it's not just the militias in the Hashd al-Shaabi. It's the uniformed militias in the Ministry of Interior, the federal police, the emergency response units, even the special operations units have been politicized. And it's unfortunate. That's a big issue. We warned about the destruction of Ramadi. We warned that you don't need to go into a city of 1.6 million, that city being Mosul, and destroy it to go after 4,000 ISIS fighters.
So let me ask you, Michael Prejean, when you look at the prospects for this referendum, I assume that you expect that the Kurds will overwhelmingly approve a separate path for their incipient country. What does that result in, as you see it? Is there likely to be a Syrian Kurdish area as well, an Iranian Kurdish area, or a unified Kurdistan? And if so, how does that play out in terms of the grand strategy of that region, Iranian and otherwise?
Well, that's the argument on the other side, those opposed to the Kurdish referendum in Iraq, is that what will it do in Iran and Syria, and how destabilizing will this be? There are seven different groups. One of the biggest problems we have talking to smart people in D.C. is the fact that they think the Kurds are one entity. The Peshmerga we're talking about that have been the most solid allies in Iraq are from the Kurdish Democratic Party and the PUK. People's Union in Kurdistan. There are seven different groups. This referendum deals with the Iraqi Kurds, and the Iraqi Kurds have proven themselves a strong U.S. ally. They are not the YPG. They are not the PKK. They are basically an ally we've counted on since 2003 with the promise that we will address their issues each year of the American occupation of Iraq, followed by diminishing leverage with Baghdad while Iran's leverage increased. So now we're telling the Kurds, delay the vote, and then we'll help you afterwards with Baghdad when we lose leverage every day and Iran gains leverage. So it doesn't make any sense. The Kurds have heard this before, and they're going to go ahead with the referendum, and they should.
Let me ask you, you mentioned that these Peshmerga elements and the parties that are affiliated with them have been our most solid allies. Is it your view that this alliance should be reflected, among other things, Michael Prejean, by having U.S. military bases in this Kurdish area of Iraq, and perhaps removing from, say, Incirlik, the forces that are currently there in Turkey under increasingly hostile circumstances?
Well, to talk about the military, the most successful military operations we've had against ISIS have actually come from joint operation bases in the Kurdish regional government area. The raids against key operatives in Syria prior to establishing a physical presence in Syria came from those bases. So there's another argument out there that the Kurdish referendum will somehow impact the war on ISIS and be destabilizing for Iraq, when in actuality the Kurds have been our most effective ally, developing intel and allowing our forces, as well as the UN and NGOs, to establish a safe operational space, because they actually the Kurdish region is actually secure. So all these Western countries that are against the referendum actually prefer to set up their NGOs and their basing in Kurdistan because it's safe, because it's secular, because it's pro-West. So Incirlik, I just separate those things out. They're not all related. It is an option. I would suggest right now that we move all military basing in Iraq to the KRG. And that's where we've been able to conduct the best operations. We're actually working with an ally as opposed to an Iranian proxy with the intelligence and security apparatus from Baghdad.
Yeah. Michael Prejean, there's so much more to talk about, including the Iran deal. We're hopeful that President Trump will heed your advice and ours, that he withdraw from it. And your leadership with the veterans against the Iran deal is tremendously appreciated. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon to talk more about that, among other things. And we appreciate your insights into the Kurdish referendum coming up and all that you've done, both in uniform and in the intelligence community, to advance our interests in that part of the world. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Shoshana Bryan about Kurdistan, Iran, and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a great pleasure to say, joined by another of the smartest people I know about matters involving the Middle East. She is Shoshana Bryan. She has over 30 years of experience, really in the front lines of national security policy and punditry these days. She is the senior director of the Jewish Policy Center and is playing an outsized role there in helping the rest of us understand what on earth is going on in the Middle East at the moment. Shoshana Bryan, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I'd like to pick up on some of the things we were just talking about with Michael Prigent, specifically about the Kurds and this referendum that is in the offing on the 25th of this month. Where do you come down on the desirability of a new Kurdish homeland, at least in part of the area of the Middle East that is populated by Kurds?
You know that at the Kurdish election rallies, they fly Israeli flags, not only because Israel helps the Kurds, but they feel the way Jews felt in 1947. At some point, you have to go and do it. You can't be deterred by the fact that the world thinks you shouldn't do it. People are telling the Kurds, don't. The Kurds think this is their moment. They're going to do it.
And I guess it's the largest population that currently has absolutely no territory, homeland of their own at the moment. It is good in your judgment and good for us as well as the people most immediately affected, of course, and the Israelis. Is that right?
It is good. It gives us an ally in the region. The Kurds want a U.S. military base. I'm not sure I would put it there yet, but that's what they want. They are pro-Western. They are democratic. They're the antidote to Sunni fundamentalism.
And hopefully Shiite fundamentalism as well, given that Iran is playing such a large and ever more dangerous role in that the rest of Iraq. When you look at Iraq and more generally that region, do you agree that the Iranians have now essentially taken over the Shiite government of Iraq and that they are using it to advance this, I guess it's been called Shia Crescent, up through Iraq into Syria and Lebanon to the Mediterranean?
The Shia Crescent is the goal. They're trying. They've got it laid out for themselves. They have a couple of stumbling blocks. One of them is in Iraq. Muqtada Sadr hates the Iranians, and he commands a lot of Shiites in Iraq. Remember, Iraqi Shiites are Arabs. Iranian Shiites are Persian. They hate each other. So it's not simple for Iran to say, look, we're all Shiites, let's make the Shiite crescent.
But that is nonetheless the goal. And one of the places where that is now causing greatest concern, it seems, Shoshana Bryan, is with the Jewish state of Israel. There is no question that as the Iranians are moving into vacuums that are being created with the destruction of the Islamic State, and the jockeying for sort of what will be the future character of Syria, that it seems as though it is moving inexorably closer and closer through its proxies, Hezbollah, the government of Syria, or others, to the Golan and the border with Israel. Is there reason for concern that we're seeing red lines being breached?
Absolutely. Think of the Shiite Crescent as a lid on top of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Israel. Saudi Arabia, by the way, being Iran's first and most important goal, not to get rid of Israel, but to enforce superiority over Saudi Arabia. So the top of the crescent is a lid on Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Israel. Israel has decided that it has red lines in Syria, and it will enforce those.
And do we know what they are, or is that something we'll find out when the Iranians breach them? Do the Iranians know what those red lines are, Shoshana Bryan?
Sort of. They include certain kinds of factories for weapons. You saw some of them disappear. You will see more of them disappear. It also includes, for example, they will not permit Hezbollah to have a permanent base on the Syrian side of the Golan Heights. Hezbollah moves back and forth through there, but the last time they tried to set up a permanent base, the Israelis took it out. Even the Russians agree with Israel that Iran should not be and Hezbollah should not be near the Israeli border.
They're close enough now, I'm afraid, for certainly the Iranians and probably Hezbollah to have launching opportunities from Syrian territory for the kinds of rockets and even missiles that the Iranians have supplied Hezbollah with that are now threatening Israel from Lebanon. Does this red line really have to contemplate that possibility as well as just a, you know, sort of land attack on the Golan from forces massed in the lowlands there?
Well, there won't be an attack from the Syrian Golan. Nobody will climb the Golan Heights to attack Israel. So you're right. The obvious would be missiles from Lebanon into Israel. If you watch the press carefully, Israel had a major military exercise in the northern part of the country designed to show Hezbollah what its approach to life would be if there was a missile attack. And since that time, Hezbollah has said a number of things. Hezbollah leadership has said a number of things about not wanting to stir the pot, not wanting to give Israel an excuse, not wanting to engage. They, I believe, at least for the moment, have been deterred by what they understood from Israel.
Well, perhaps in part because of the bloodletting that they've been subjected to in Syria over the past couple of years. And that brings me to the larger question, of course, of Israel's security, a tremendously important strategic ally of the United States in a very dangerous part of the world, in addition to the missile threats from Lebanon, Shoshana Bryan, as you know. Gaza has been a festering sore for Israel ever since it, in my judgment, foolishly withdrew from there. What are we to make of the announcement yesterday that the Fatah movement and Hamas were going to, really, try to patch things up and have some kind of unity government, that Hamas is going to be making certain changes in its character to accommodate Fatah and all the rest? Is this more of the same, or does this open up a new and potentially threatening arrangement for the state of Israel?
Between the Palestinian groups, it's a diversionary move. They do it every other year. They do it whenever they think they need to. Don't pay any attention to that. However, the United States has said it's important to put the Gaza Strip back under the control of the Palestinian Authority. They're never going to do it. I'm not worried about it. But the reason it's important for the United States to say it is because it answers a question for Israel. People have been pushing the idea of a West Bank Palestinian state and leaving Gaza for later. If you leave Gaza for later, you settle a problem over here and leave a festering sore on Israel's west coast. You can't do that. This is at least recognition that the third Palestinian state after Jordan, after the West Bank, is and it has to be dealt with in the same context. You can't leave it for later. Will they succeed? No. Is it important that they understand that you cannot dismiss Gaza and say, never mind, in 50 years we'll get to Gaza? That's very important. I give a big plus to the administration for that one.
Good. Well, I did want to ask you about the view you take of what the Trump administration is doing more generally with respect to Israel and our policies towards the Jewish state. There's been a lot of talk of General McMaster being hostile to Israel. I don't know where you come down on that, but I'd be interested in whether your view of Jared Kushner and his peacemaking and the rest of it is translating into the kind of real reversal of policy that President Trump promised with respect to the Obama hostility towards Israel.
Well, I think he has reversed the Obama hostility. General McMaster, I do not think he's anti-Israel, but remember that General McMaster's career was spent in CENTCOM. It was spent with the Gulf states at a time that the Gulf states were not friendly to Israel. That's changing. So his inputs are a little different. I don't think he's hostile. As for Kushner and Greenblatt, the interesting thing is that this idea that there's no rapid deal, there's no push to a conclusion, this is their view. And I think that's very healthy.
Well, it's certainly more realistic than was some of the early talk about getting something done right away. Shoshana Bryan, as always, your insights into all of these complex and highly dynamic aspects of the current Middle East are tremendously appreciated, as is the work you do at the Jewish Policy Center. I hope you'll come back to us very soon and look forward to that. Kevin Freeman joins us next. We'll talk with him about the latest assaults on the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world and what that might mean for you. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert at the Center for Security Policy on matters involving economic warfare. He is the founder of globaleconomicwarfare.com, a tremendous blog and great resource. Also, Kevin Freeman is the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. So good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
For some time, Kevin, you have been warning about threats to the U.S. dollar's status as the reserve currency of the world. Remind us briefly, before we get into what the current threats to that status are, why it's so important to our economy and, well, frankly, to our security.
The fact that we have now over $20 trillion of U.S. government debt, that money's got to come from somewhere, and it comes from the Federal Reserve can produce it out of thin air and buy our U.S. Treasury debt, which is monetizing it, which you can do that up to a point, but if you do that exclusively, you have what Zimbabwe and Venezuela and Weimar Germany, you have a complete collapse of the currency because you're basically buying something for nothing. So you can do some of that, but you can't do all of it. Then you have the American public or the domestic public can buy the debt, and then you have the foreign governments that buy our debt. And we've been blessed to be the reserve currency of the world so that when somebody has extra money, they turn and buy U.S. Treasury debt, which has allowed us to fund our government. If that stops happening, which is what Russia and China have been calling for, then we have fewer people buying our debt, which means that it ripples through the economy. Debt becomes more expensive across the board. We don't have 1%, 2%, 5% interest rates. They go up to 10%. And you have 10% interest rates on a U.S. $20 trillion debt, and you have $2 trillion a year you have to come up with just to pay the interest, which means we'll have to cut defense spending or Social Security or all. It's just a bad situation if we don't have people buying our debt.
Right. And so let's talk about the concerted efforts that the Russians and Chinese have been making now for some time to basically supplant the dollar with one form of currency or another. Kevin Freeman, you've observed that the dollar's value is considerably down over what it was last year. Is that a function of this concerted effort by the Russians and Chinese, or is it simply something they're now capitalizing on? And if so, how?
The dollar is down about 10% for the year, which is one of the largest declines to a start of a year, since 1985. What that means is that if you go overseas, you get about 10% less purchasing power for the dollar than you would have had last year at this time. But that's fairly normal. It's the currencies do swing, and it's possible we had a huge run-up in the valuation of the dollar, and now it's just normalizing. That's the hope. But if Putin presses, if the Chinese press, if Venezuela presses, which they're apparently trying to do, but they have no economic power to do so, if they push on it, they could make the run on the dollar pretty serious. And if people do turn away from the dollar, it will be very detrimental to our economy in the long run.
Well, let's come back to Russia and China, but for a moment, stay with Venezuela. This is, as you say, a country that is now essentially bankrupt. What is it they're doing, and how could it possibly be of any consequence with respect to the U.S. dollar and as a currency for purchasing oil from them?
Well, on the surface, it's a joke for Venezuela to say that they're going to price their oil in the Chinese currency rather than the U.S. dollars is a complete joke. But behind that, what they're saying is we are a client state of Russia and China. That's the statement. It makes absolutely zero sense for them to avoid the U.S. dollar. They're in our hemisphere. We have been historically their largest buyer. Their largest assets are based around the United States, and therefore it really is ridiculous for them in their economic condition to claim that they could avoid using the U.S. dollar. The fact that they're doing it says we now belong 100% to Putin and China.
Yeah. And that presumably suits the Russians and Chinese. Just as a practical matter, Kevin Freeman, would that mean that if we were to continue to purchase oil from PDVSA, the Venezuelan oil conglomerate, that we would have to convert dollars into Chinese yuan to make those transactions? Or is this practical terms not on?
I can't imagine in practical terms it actually working, but that's the claim. And just imagine that we would have to convert our dollar to buy oil from our own hemisphere.
And in the process, prop up the regime in Caracas. I mean, that's the double irony here. We shouldn't be doing that, it seems to me. But Kevin Freeman, so the Russians and the Chinese have been at this for some time. There have been a number of different plays. You were with me in Dallas yesterday, where one of our colleagues, Rich Higgins, talked about the Chinese possibly seeking to advance this larger agenda through a play when Saudi Aramco finally brings its IPO for 5% of their worth, I guess, to the capital markets, now scheduled, as I understand it, for early 2018. Do you see that as part of this larger agenda? And more generally, how successful are the Russians and Chinese in pulling this off?
Well, first off, Aramco, the reason that they're selling 5%, and they've talked about asking $100 billion for 5%, which would value Aramco at $2 trillion. They're doing that because they need money, and they need money because they started an oil war with the shale producers here in America and basically lost. And we've talked about that before. But now they're turning for money, and China might step up. What Rich suggested is China may be the buyer of much of that, which they would eventually get Saudi Arabia to reprice oil into their own currency away from the dollar. And that, again, would further this. So that it potentially ties in very much. It's a part of the intricate global economic war, the games that we're seeing. Saudi Arabia needs cash, and China has it.
Yeah, well, economic warfare is your business, so we value very much your keeping us abreast of what's happening, and you can do that at globaleconomicwarfare.com, folks. Lastly, Kevin, we've been talking throughout the program about Kurdistan as a prospective new player, at least a part of the Kurdish prospective nation, the Iraqi part, having a referendum soon to determine whether it will break off from the rest of Iraq. The Russians, speaking of their games, have apparently consummated a deal with their company Rosneft to do a gas pipeline with Iraq's Kurdistan. Could you talk a little bit about the strategic implications of that?
Well, again, it all comes back to a couple of things. It's money and it's energy. This is an attempt by the Russians to break apart the Middle East and put their influence there. The Kurdistan, and I'm not a geopolitical expert, but they have been working with the United States in the area, and this is Russia using money to purchase influence.
And to the extent that they are able, through a gas arrangement that I gather would work through Turkey to Europe, this is part of presumably a geostrategic play by Putin to increase his influence, not just in the Middle East, of course, but elsewhere in the world. Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm so grateful to you for your expertise in all these matters, your role as our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, as well as your very important output at globaleconomicwarfare.com. And also, of course, I commend to all of you again his books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin Freeman, come back to us again very soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.